I'm Mark Steiner, and we are covering for the third day the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. We ran into Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn at the conference. You remember Bill Ayers was the one who caused all that hoopla, or they caused it around him at any rate, trying to accuse Barack Obama of being an American radical for having a friendship with Bill Ayers, who was a former weatherman. He and Bernadine Dorn were both part of that, but they're social activists. She's a lawyer and a constitutional law professor. He's an educator and an educational thinker. We ran into them here, and they talked to us about their work here at the Social Forum and the fascinating work going on in Chicago. So here's that interview. I'm Mark Steiner, still reporting to you from the U.S. Social Forum here in Detroit, and we are... It's a pleasure to have once again with this one, not here, but once again on our show, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. Good to see y'all.
Hey,
nice
Mark.
To see you, Mark.
So I'm really curious about these workshops you both are about to do. We're going to have this interview. You're going to dash off and do some workshops. Well, so talk about your workshops, Bernadine.
Well, we're just part of other workshops, but I'm about to race off to a workshop of Ella's Daughters, which is a national network of primarily young women of color, but young women or women. Now I'm older and not of color.
Ain't we all?
But allies of Ella's Daughter, named after Ella Baker, one of the founding mothers of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in 1960. And Ella Baker, you know, believed in grassroots organizing, that the people with the problems are the people with the solutions, and that community organizers and students and people who went out to organize radical change had to listen and learn from the people who have the problems. She was against hierarchical, passionate male leadership, who she thought could easily mislead the movement as well. She's famous for saying the movement made Martin. Martin didn't make the movement. And so Barbara Ransby has written a biography of Ella Baker, and she came up with this idea of having an organization called Ella's Daughters, where the issues around organizing women and girls and women and girls organizing other issues around the country could be under one kind of network, and we could draw strength from each other. So there is an Ella's Daughters workshop going on here
very
now,
cool.
And I will be dashing off to it.
That's great. But which one are you going to
be? I'm going to be in an education workshop based on the notion of teaching for social justice. One of the things about a meeting like this, and I'm sure you've experienced it already, is it's so yeasty, it's so propulsive, it's so various that you can't do everything you'd like to do.
Right.
But that's, if you put your head in a certain space, that's okay. You can get a lot, learn a lot, give a lot. Really, it's an opportunity to talk to lots of people. The workshop I'm going to is about social justice. It's about trying to change the frame around which the conversation about schools and school reform takes place in this country. The frame is a frame that says education is a product, like a refrigerator or a stove, something you buy at the marketplace. We argue that education is a human right, education is a human process, and we've got lots and lots of energy going into kind of trying to reframe that issue for the future, for the immediate future, and then down the line. And we see these kinds of conversations nationally as essential to building networks of teachers, parents, and citizens who understand education as a progressive and forward-charging enterprise.
I wonder how you look at this conference in a different way, that here we have 10,000, perhaps more, activists, most of them young activists in their 20s and 30s and some in their 40s, and then there's us.
And then there's us. Yep.
But I wonder...
Somebody's got to hold up that part of the sky.
That's true.
That's what makes it intergenerational.
No, that's what I'm just yeah, this is lovely. I think it's a really important thing that it is intergenerational, and we see these young people, communities of color from all over America here. But in some ways, this is... Some people look at this and say, okay, this is wonderful, but it's also isolated, that people don't know what's even going on, that it's not, that story's not being told. So in the sense of the battle for social change and for a certain vision of America, talk about that in terms of what could be the power of this and the isolation of this and how those things
go. I don't think this is the anti-isolation part of it, because we know that all across the United States and, of course, globally, tremendous radical organizing, I mean politically left radical organizing, against permanent war, against, you know, the failures of capitalism at this time, and against inequality, and for a vision of living differently, living on the earth differently, and living together in a way that's sustainable and humane and nonviolent. I think these things are essential agreements here, but in a wide variety of areas. And we all know what's going on, but it's very rare to see it all in one place. And, of course, the mainstream media, apart from you all and your colleagues here, is not present even a little. They will show up wherever there's 15 teabaggers and make it a story for an entire 2 weeks, but they will not cover an incredible organization like this, the results of this incredible organizing effort, where people have come by bikes and vans and trains from all over the United States. So that's a given that we're not going to get covered by them.
You know, but I also think that when we think of Chicago, this has been being built for a year. We're going to go back and build off of this. We're going to report back. And one of the things we have to figure out, all of us who are part of the movement, is that we don't need to get our affirmation from the New York Times or from, you know, the mainstream media, that affirmation isn't coming. It's kind of, there's an analogy. A lot of times people get deflated and they feel like they've got to pay all their attention to the power in the White House or the Congress or the Pentagon or Wall Street, when actually we have power in the classroom, the community, you know, the workplace, and that's the power we have access to. Similarly with being reported. Believe me, in Chicago, people are going to know that this happened. They're going to know because we're going to report back, because we've got deep, deep ties into the grassroots. And because this, you're building an alternative media, because the kids have other ways of talking to one another. So I'm not despairing at all. And in fact, I think we've got to develop a kind of politics of confidence as we develop new ways of talking horizontally to one another, not relying on the Times to give us an estimate of how many people showed up at our demonstration.
Can I add one other thing to this? You know, most of the issues, not all of them, but most of the issues here, a majority of people in the United States agree with. So a vast majority of people are against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but don't know what to do about it, feel powerless to stop the military machine that is the national security state, you know, where there's no saying no, no matter what economic crisis we're into, whatever the military and the national security state at home want, they get. Doesn't matter what it costs. We don't even discuss where the money's going to come from there. But how do we... So our challenge is not to convince people. They're already convinced, in a way, that this is a disaster, right? And a waste, a terrible, tragic human waste of resources to be just a military state. And yet feel powerless to change it. So that's why the grassroots work is so important, even though it seems invisible, because it really is about amplifying the voices of returning vets, for example, who I think have the most, them and their families have the most powerful message about what a tragedy and a disaster these wars are, and why we have to get off not only the fossil fuel economy, but the war economy, in order to build a humane alternative and live differently so that others may live.
Now, I know we only have a little bit of time because you've got to run off and do your workshops, which is really important to do here, which is one of the reasons you're here. But you also came here with a huge group of people from Chicago, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I know in different places around here we've talked a bit about what's going on in Chicago, but I want our listeners to really get a sense of what's happening in Chicago, and that it's really phenomenal. And I didn't know about it until I heard the two of you talking about it.
Yeah. Well, among other things, you know, there's a depth of cultural work by young people. I think sometimes, especially us, tend to talk only about the so-called heavy political issues. But for young people, the work in the arts and imagination is a very important way of organizing, of transmitting the message, of being able to speak back to people. So that's one thing. Another is there's a long struggle around prisoner rights, around ending the death penalty, around fighting police violence and police torture. Last weekend in Chicago, there were 80 shootings. 80 shootings. I mean, and it's true for Detroit, too. We live in cities that are sites of violence that are like war
Baltimore's
zones.
The same.
Very
right.
much like war zones. And yet, of course, they're very specifically segregated in communities of color. And so people live in oblivion. People with privilege and white people with money live in oblivion to what's going on in other parts of the city. So I think in that sense, Chicago has this tradition of fighting back. I mean, we're very proud of the fact that, you know, the death penalty was taken off of the table after a 10-year struggle there, that we've been fighting for 40 years against police torture that went on for a 20-year period and then another 20 years of impunity. So these are issues, I think, that galvanize people and where there's actually something you can do about it. You can act about it, and you can gather allies from other areas of work.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of solidarity of working on each other's issues, not just tactically and temporarily, but because we're in a conversation about what is this moment we're in, how do we name our historical moment, and what are the opportunities and barriers to really building a sense of powerful movements or a movement, one big movement for social justice.
And you talked also earlier about, the acronym was ICHI, ICHA?
IJA.
IJA.
IJA, IJA, IJA. IJA.
It's Immigrant IJA. Youth Justice League. And what this is you know, Bernadine mentioned that Chicago is the heart of, in many ways, of the immigrant rights movement, and people have mobilized in Chicago, and these big national marches began in Chicago a few years ago. But the young people have taken it a whole step further, and that is they've organized a group called the Immigrant Youth Justice League, and they carry around big banners and signs that say undocumented and unafraid. They're the folks you heard about who sat in John McCain's office. They were many of them Chicagoans. But these are folks who are saying, let's up the ante here. We are human beings. We have human rights. And the idea that on some technicality you're going to kick us out of the country because we got here when we were 2 years old, no, you're not. We're going to stand up and we're going to fight for our rights. And it's a beautiful and bold thing to behold. And, you know, speaking of generational splits, we look at these kids and say, please be careful. You know, don't hurt yourselves. And,
these are the young people who were born before their parents brought them to the United States. So they're
right.
not citizens, but they've grown up their whole lives here. And among the things they're fighting for is the DREAM Act, a very simple reform strategy, right, which would allow them to have path to citizenship, allow them to work, allow them to have driver's licenses, allow them to live their lives. Most of them have gone to college here, but without the ability to take the next step into their lives, and they're just blocked, you know, the way people coming out of prison are blocked, the way gay and lesbian people have been blocked and made invisible their whole lives. So this IGIL organization is really promoting the DREAM Act, but also, I think, in my mind, kind of a symbol of the whole idiocy of saying some of us are real citizens mm-hmm. and some of us are not real citizens.
I guess, and finally, I'm going to let you all run to your workshops here. What's really interesting to me is, I mean, all of us, the three of us sitting here together now, when we were in our 20s, were very much involved in the revolutionary movement, involved in SDS, involved in SNCC, involved in lots of things, sacrificing a lot. You went underground for a long time and now are back in professional lives, raising children in the open. And we're here seeing all these young people in their teens and 20s and 30s. And it seems to have you seem to be energized by this. I mean, looking at the two of you and watching you interact out here, you seem to both really, really energized being in this place.
You too, Mark. They're terrific. They're brilliant. And I think our job is to support them, to promote their voices, to join in their issues, to make allow them the space. They demand the space. We're not just permitting it. They demand the space to define their own issues, to shape their own strategies. And they're generous enough, in a way maybe we weren't, to think they have something to learn and to ask for solidarity and support.
We started a group called Friends of IGIL, which is modeled on Friends of SNCC. The idea is not to take over their issue and tell them how to run it, but rather to create the kind of solidarity that can be there when it's necessary. And so those are examples of a kind of, yes, energized is exactly right. But then, you know, we're in our 60s, mid-60s, mid-late 60s. You look at Grace Lee Boggs here in Detroit. She's 95. And she's energized as hell by this.
And
she's
Vincent
been building
Harding, too.
Vincent Harding in his 80s is here. A lot of folks are here. It's a very, very exciting time. Thanks, Mark, so much.
Good to see you both. Bill Aspron,
you're
doing great workshops. Thank
hey.
You. Good to see you both. Love you all. Yesterday we had a conversation with some young Iraq War veterans, and we talked about the most interesting caravan they have, made up of Iraq veterans, people from Gaza, and Iraqis. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back for another one of our conversations here from the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. Pleasure to have Josh Stieber back with us. He's Iraq Veterans Against the War. Connor Curran, who is Veterans for Peace, and Salem Talib from Iraq. I'm really interested in this journey the three of you are taking and how this began and what are you all doing. Connor, you want to begin? You're right there?
Sure. Well, it's been a constant evolution, really. And the point we're at now with the three of us here, and we're joined also by two girls in Gaza Strip, from the Gaza Strip, and some students from Afghanistan. We talked to them via Skype. It kind of started from a journey Josh did last year as he got out of the Army, deciding, as a conscientious objector, deciding that he wanted to spread peaceful, nonviolent solutions instead of the military solutions he had been doing for a while. And doing that, he walked and biked across the country, ran into me, and I joined him for the rest of the way from Ohio. And then the last place we stayed was with Salam in Berkeley, California. And we were sitting together one of the nights where we were there and just enjoying each other's company, drinking some tea late at night. And we just kind of started laughing, thinking that just a couple of years ago we could have been shooting at each other. And here, just in the situation where we actually sat down and got to know each other, we were instant great best friends. And we thought that that was a message that needed to go across the world, that these two peoples who are supposed to be the innate enemies or something, Middle Easterns and Americans, are really just best friends waiting to happen, and given the opportunity that we can sit down and dialogue and talk with each other. So going from that idea, Josh was contacted by students from Afghanistan that wanted to come over here with that same thought, just dialogue, put a face on the people of Afghanistan, and just kind of spread the message that when we actually take the time to get to know each other, we can't hate each other and spread violence. We're only really set up as humans to be friends, and that's just kind of shines through whatever situations we have if we let it.
So, Salam, tell us a bit about your story. You're in Berkeley, but you're from Iraq. So talk about the journey from there to there.
I lived in Iraq all my life. I came here about 4 years ago. The journey itself has just started. You know, I never thought in my life that I'm going to leave Iraq. And 2003, I started working with journalists a lot, and I was working as translator, fixer. And then become a journalist myself, because it was very dangerous for them to report. So I started taking their positions. And by time, it became that clear that it's too dangerous to continue this kind of work. So I left to Jordan. And from Jordan, I applied for lots of countries. And the country that I have the most friends in, it was America. And I ended up in America.
So you said something interesting as we were walking towards the table. You said, it reminds you of the Hotel Palestine in Baghdad. What did you mean by that?
The setting here, when Iraq was occupied, I mean, when they took the pictures of the statue being pulled down, that was right. This statue, it was well targeted, because that statue, it's where the media center is in Iraq, which is all the media around the world. They came and they stayed in Palestine Hotel and the Sheraton, which is that right across the street from each other. And they make it later. The military made it as a complex for the military operations before the Green Zone. And when I walked in here, I thought that's the closest chaos that can happen. It's very random, and all media and everyone trying to film something.
And you had to leave Iraq?
Correct.
Just for your own safety?
Yes.
Because you were translating for Americans?
Not translating for Americans, but if I was, like this term is mixed, because translating for Americans, it's taken in Iraq as translating for the U.S. military. And
right.
Those are the people are usually targeted. But it was no clear distinguish between who's military and who's not.
Right.
And that's where the confusion came.
Josh? We've talked before, but just to reintroduce our listeners, I mean, that you were in the Army and became a conscientious objector.
Yeah, I became a conscientious objector, or got approved a little more than a year ago after a 14-month deployment to Baghdad, where I started being able to kind of put myself in other people's shoes. And so the journey that we're on now is really a continuation of that, of trying to put a human face on, you know, people at the other side of a gun, which can be so hard to do in kind of the isolated American culture, and also once you're in the military.
I'm curious what the three of you are doing on this journey, plus the young women from Gaza who are with you, right?
Right.
So what are you doing on this journey? I mean, tell me what happens and who you talk to and where you go out to. And
we've been able to set up a speaking event just about every night. So we started in Berkeley, where Salam's from, and drove all the way through the southern part of the country and worked our way up the East Coast, and now we're looping back around through the north. And yeah, like I said, speaking event just about every night, and get a great opportunity kind of to go through all our different stories and then interact with all kinds of different audiences and just spark these conversations. And yeah, really just get a chance to dialogue with a lot of different communities.
And talk about the dialogue. What happens? I mean, what when you create these things between the five of you, the three of you, what happens with the audience? What are you focusing on?
Well, a lot of times we'll talk with Josh and myself. We'll talk about some of the trainings and mindsets that led us into the military and the transformations.
You were in what?
I was in the Marine Corps.
In the Marine Corps.
And we'll talk about that and show some of video clips about what really happened in war, and Salam will tell about his experience growing up in Iraq, being through three wars, and the girls from Gaza will relate their experiences from the Gaza Strip. And it's just usually such a large, massive amount of information people hadn't been exposed to before that I think, even though there's a lot of people in agreement with our message in the audience, there's a lot mm-hmm. of people who are usually shocked about the way we have been trained or some of the tactics that we have been using abroad as Americans. And so a lot of times the dialogue includes people wanting to know more about that kind of thing, and a lot of times it's also people being excited about trying to continue this message of making connections and just building friendships and relationships with other people throughout the globe.
And I was interested, Salam, I have other friends here in the country who are also Iraqi who have actually had to leave Iraq. I have one friend who goes back and forth. He's about to go back again. Imad, who's Raju, is a broadcaster in Iraq. But everybody I know wants to get back. I mean, the people are frustrated by the idea they have to leave the land they were born in continue their lives.
That's a very complicated issue.
It is a complicated
issue. Which
yeah.
is, you know, the feel of identity and the difference between, you know, the culture here and culture there and where you are attached to wherever you were born. But it's still, for Iraq, it's a very special case because Iraq is in a war, and the war that's the country that we're staying in is in a war there. So
right.
It makes it very special circumstances. But within that, you know, we appreciate the people here, and we appreciate that we have place to be. But it's still like I've been here for 40 years, but as the years going on, I feel that the distance is growing between me and Iraq, and the you know the mentality and the way of thinking, and also still it's still frustrating just because it's not option yet to go back and reset your system.
So, one of the things you said, I think it was you who said it, Connor. A couple of things you also said struck me, and one was that you're on this tour with one another, and you realize that at some point you could have been shooting at one another on different sides of the divide. And it made me think of a good friend of mine who is another Jarhead, who's a Marine veteran from my era in the Vietnam War, and he was a Marine helicopter gunner. And came back, and when he came back, he helped organize the VVAW, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and became a really phenomenal writer. He's written some incredible books about Vietnam and many other things, and he organized this first conference between Vietnamese writers and American writers, and everybody was a veteran from either side. And one of the things happened to him, I'm telling this story because I want to get your reaction, the three of you, to where we've come to with this. He was in this table, sitting across from this woman, Lee Minh Quê, incredible writer and poet from Vietnam. She was North Vietnamese, but cleared the trails in the Ho Chi Minh Trail. She was taking out the wounded and clearing the trail and dealing with when she was 16. And he was a gunner. And they looked at each other and realized that they could have killed one another when they were younger. If she saw him, would be terrified. And she had a gun, she had tried to shoot him down, and he would have blown her away manning a gun in the copter, right? So I'm just curious about this. So here we are. Here we are 40 years later, and you're saying the same thing. You're saying the exact same thing.
Right, and, you know, I think it's just this universal truth that when we do come together and are able to sit down, that we are innately friends and that we've been put on blinders to be able to do that, whether by governments, the way we relate to each other in our day-to-day life, whatever. We've just kind of perpetuated this idealism of violence and war when my story's echoing one from a generation past, and I'm sure thousands of generations past too, and that's kind of one of the things that we really feel is important about the journey that we're going on, that we don't want to continue to let this idea of separation continue to perpetuate, that we want to speak out about how we are these as humans, how we are just innately connected and friendly, and that given the opportunity, we'll become the best of friends, and we want to start taking down the walls and barriers that have been put up around the world and in our societies that prevent those connections from happening, because it's such a crazy thing to be able to look at one of your greatest friends and think, wow, I could have killed him and this great relationship would have never been possible.
So to conclude this, where do the three of you think we should go from here, and how do we get there? I mean, here we're still stuck in Iraq, in a war. We're still stuck in Afghanistan. And then I meet friends of mine who are Afghan and Iraqi, and they sometimes get very conflicted about how quickly Americans should go. They want Americans gone because it's tearing apart their country, but their country's been torn apart. And how do you keep it together? So, I mean, we're in a very difficult moment. And I'm curious what you all three think about where we go from this moment. Go ahead, Salam, please.
Personally, I think that it's the problem has been created for a really long time. It's in Iraq, at least, it's been 7 years. And the imagination that there is a magical solution, we just do one thing and then that's it, then solves the problem, that's not right at all. It's not. feasible. So I think that the destruction that happened in Iraq, it's naturally that will take a natural amount of organic time to regrow to a natural country again. In Iraq now, for example, the first year of the occupation, the problems, if you look at the news and look, start study it, you'll find the problems is just gangsters running the streets trying to steal things, and there were no problem of violent or anything, pretty much. And there is a problem of electricity and water, and that's what people ask for. And then the next year, you will have a problem of detainees and Abu Ghraib and Fallujah and attacks and roadside bombs, and then year three you'll get a different story, which is roadside bombs and all these things. So as you see, if you see the history, it's getting more complicated every day. So the solution is for the military to withdraw, for sure. That's because that's the history of occupations around the world. It's not just we're going to invent it right now. How they withdraw, all the Americans, when they talk about withdraw, they imagine that the American military just disappear overnight. And that's not going to happen. It's not even doable, because there are 150,000 troops, 120,000 mercenaries, and millions of equipments. So it's not going to happen overnight, even if they want to. But the idea of it should happen, that we should take the military out of Iraq, out of the cities at least, it has to happen, because we know from a few experience that military and cities, they don't meet if they can't coexist. So the idea of withdrawal, I think it's should be the idea to start with, and then we will think about reparations, how to fix Iraq. The sectarian violence will happen, maybe there are a lot of evidence might happen, but even it happened, it will happen now or later.
Yeah, I guess for a while I kind of bought into the excuse that, this war is wrong, but we need to stay there and act kind of as a babysitter, that we're keeping things from getting even worse. And then that assumption kind of went away when I saw that exact thing happen, that we were in Baghdad, and towards the end of my deployment in, this would have been 2008, and violence got really horrible there. A lot of sectarian fighting was going on within a couple-day period, and we didn't do anything about it. We just stayed in the factory that we were living out of, and who knows how many people were killed as we heard gunfire going on for pretty much 3 or 4 straight days. So that excuse fell apart for me, that we're there in case things get bad enough, but things got horrible, and we didn't do anything about it. And kind of like to bounce off what Salam was saying, to make kind of an analogy, I think the longer we stay there, that, yeah, if we leave, that there are definitely going to be challenges, but the longer we're there, the worse we make it. And to kind of make an analogy, it would be like in the American Civil War or any conflict like that, if an outside country, say France or whatever, were to, when the South started losing, would start giving them money and weapons, and then when the North started losing, give them money and weapons. Like we were negotiating with the weaker side, who would turn to us when they got too weak to fight on their own. So things were staying about the same in terms of power structure, but we were throwing that much more money and weapons into the mix. That's just going to prolong it in the long run and make it that much harder to withdraw when we finally decide we should.
So tell me, as we conclude, Connor, what's the name of this tour? What's the name of the tour you're doing?
We are calling it The People's Journey. And we have a website where we're just keeping track of everything we're doing with an itinerary and blog, and that can be found at thepeoplesjourney.org.
I can't tell you how much it means to me to see the three of you together and hear about what you're doing with these two women from Gaza traveling the country. This is very important stuff. And Josh Devers, good to have you. Connor Curran from Veterans for Peace, and Salam Tlaib. You guys, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
It's been an honor to have you with us. Thank you. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.meqcu.org. MECU.com.